It was a humid August evening in Chicago. The kind where the air sticks to your skin. I'd matched with Ethan on a dating app. His profile boasting a charming smile and a bio that read, "Hopeless romantic seeking his forever." I figured, why not? I was 28, single, and ready for something new. The date started at a cozy Italian restaurant in the Loop. Ethan was handsome, tall, with tousled brown hair and piercing blue eyes that seemed to see right through me. He was charismatic, cracking jokes and telling stories about his travels. But barely 30 minutes in, he leaned across the table, his eyes gleaming with an intensity that made my stomach twist. "Sarah," he said, his voice low and serious. "I know this is fast, but I want to marry you." I laughed, thinking it was a quirky icebreaker.
"What, like, right now? Slow down, cowboy."
"No, Sarah, I'm serious," he insisted, grabbing my hand. "I married my first wife 3 weeks after meeting her, my second 2 weeks. And I want to break my record with you. 1 week, one day. We could be at City Hall by midnight." I blinked, my fork froze in midair.
"You're joking, right?"
He grinned. But it wasn't playful. It was manic. "I've never been more serious about anything in my life. You're the one, Sarah. I can feel it." I played along, thinking he was just eccentric. We finished dinner, and he suggested a cab to keep the night going. I agreed, still chuckling at his proposal stunt. But when he leaned forward and told the driver, "City Hall, please," my heart dropped.
"Ethan, what the hell?"
I snapped, my voice sharp enough to make the driver glance back. "Trust me, Sarah, this is fate," he said, his hand gripping mine too tightly. I yanked my hand free, my pulse racing. "Stop the car, please," I told the driver. "I gotta be somewhere." I bolted out at a red light, my heels clicking against the pavement as I blocked Ethan's number on my phone. I thought that was the end of it. I was wrong. The next day I was home. I was sipping coffee when the doorbell rang. I opened it to find Ethan standing there, his eyes red-rimmed, his clothes rumpled.
"Sarah, I'm so sorry. I came on too strong. Can we talk, please?"
he said, voice breaking. Against my better judgment, I let him in. He looked pathetic, like a kicked puppy. "You have 5 minutes," I said, crossing my arms. He nodded, stepping inside.
"I just want to explain." Before I could react, he pulled a small canister from his pocket and sprayed something in my face. A sharp chemical smell hit me, and the room spun. My knees buckled and everything went black. When I came to, my wrist burned from tight ropes, and a rag was stuffed in my mouth, tasting of sweat and dust. I was in the back seat of a car, the city lights replaced by dark, empty fields. Ethan was in the driver's seat. He glanced back, noticing I was awake.
"Oh, good, you're up,"
he said, pulling over onto a deserted stretch of road. He climbed into the back, his face inches from mine, and yanked the gag out.
"Sarah, I need you to hear this. I love you very much. You need to marry me, tonight."
My throat was dry, but I managed to croak out.
"You're insane. Let me go."
His face darkened and he pulled a syringe from his jacket, the needle glinting in the moonlight.
"Don't make this hard, Sarah," he said, his voice cold. "We're meant to be." He pricked my chest with a needle, just enough to sting. I gasped, the pain sharp and real. He did it again, harder, and tears welled in my eyes. "Okay, I'll marry you, just stop!"
I screamed. He smiled like a kid who'd won a prize.
"That's my girl."
We drove to a seedy 24-hour chapel in the outskirts of the city. The officiant, a greasy man with a stained shirt, didn't blink at my disheveled state or the rope marks on my wrists. Ethan had cash, and that was enough for him. I said I'd do through gritted teeth, my mind racing for an escape. The certificate was signed, and Ethan beamed, oblivious to the hatred in my eyes. Back at his dingy apartment, I played the part of the doting wife. Biding my time, Ethan was a drifter, barely scraping by on odd jobs. His romantic facade hiding a fractured mind. He rambled about his ex-wives, how they'd betrayed him, how I was his final chance at love. I nodded, smiled, and planned. A week later, I slipped out while he slept, using his own phone to call a friend for a ride. I went straight to the police, but Ethan had vanished by the time they raided his place. The cops found photos of me, hundreds of them, taken from a distance, long before our date. He'd been stalking me for months, building a fantasy I never knew I was a part of. I wasn't going to let him win. I hired one of Chicago's top divorce lawyers, a shark named Rachel Klein who ate cases like Ethan's for breakfast. "This guy is a lunatic," she said, flipping through the police report. "Don't worry, we'll bury him." "Be sure to make it hurt," I replied. Rachel dug into Ethan's past. His first wife was a woman he'd coerced into a fake marriage in Vegas, annulled after she fled. His second wife didn't even exist, just a story he told to seem charmingly impulsive. He'd been in and out of psych wards, dodging charges for harassment and fraud. The man was a walking con, and I was his latest mark. In court, Ethan showed up in a cheap suit, still grinning like he'd won me over. "Sarah, I love you. We're soulmates," he said from the stand, voice dripping with sincerity. "Save it. You kidnapped me, you psycho." I shot back. The judge wasn't impressed by Ethan's theatrics. Rachel painted him as a predator, using the photos, the police report, and my testimony to secure a divorce and a hefty alimony settlement. Ethan had little money, but Rachel went after his assets, a beat-up car, a small savings account, even his collection of rare coins he'd bragged about. She left him with nothing. By the time it was over, Ethan was homeless, sleeping in alleys and shelters. I'd heard he'd taken to telling strangers about his marriage records, spinning tales of whirlwind romances to anyone who'd listen. He laughed, his eyes wild, as if he still believed he was a romantic hero.
I remember that trip like it was yesterday, even though it's been a couple of years now. I was 28, fresh out of a messy breakup with my ex, Jason, who thought it was a great idea to cheat on me with his coworker. You know the type, charming until they're not. Anyway, I needed to get away, clear my head. So I booked a solo road trip up the California coast. Nothing fancy, just me, my beat-up Honda Civic, and a playlist full of Taylor Swift anthems to scream-sing along to. I figured stopping at quirky B&Bs along the way would add some adventure, make me feel independent and alive again. The place I ended up that night was in this tiny town called Mendocino, right on the edge of the Pacific. The owner, a sweet older lady named Mrs. Hargrove, greeted me at the door with a warm hug like we'd known each other forever. "Oh, honey, you look like you could use a good night's rest," she said, her voice all soft and southern, even though we were in NorCal. "The shared bathroom's down the hall, but don't worry, everyone's real respectful here." I nodded, forcing a smile. "Thanks, Mrs. Hargrove, I'm just beat from the drive. Any other guests tonight?" She tilted her head, counting on her fingers. "Well, there's Mr. Thompson in room 3, he's a writer. Keeps to himself. And then there's that nice young couple in room 5 on their honeymoon. Oh, and a performer fella in room 2. He's a bit eccentric, but harmless." She winked. "Artists, you know?" I laughed it off. "Ha. As long as no one's blasting music at midnight, I'm good." I hauled my suitcase up the stairs, unpacked a bit, and crashed early. The bed was comfy, with those feather pillows that swallow your head, and the ocean waves crashing outside lulled me right to sleep. But around 2 a.m., nature called. And not in a polite way. I was bursting for a pee, the kind where you wake up in a panic, convinced you're about to embarrass yourself. The hallway light was dim, just a nightlight plugged into the wall, casting long shadows on the faded carpet. I shuffled down in my oversized t-shirt and yoga pants, yawning, my eyes half shut. The bathroom door was cracked open a sliver. No light on inside, so I figured it was empty. I pushed it open without knocking. Big mistake. There he was, this guy, squatting in the middle of the bathroom floor, fully dressed in a mime costume. Black and white striped shirt, black pants, white gloves, the whole deal. His face was painted stark white, with exaggerated black lips and those creepy arched eyebrows. He wasn't on the toilet. He was just hunched down, like he was about to, well, you know. But his trousers were still up, zipped and everything. No sign of anything happening down there. But he was pushing, silently straining, his face all contorted in this weird, exaggerated mime expression. I froze.
What the?
I whispered, my voice cracking. He looked up, locked eyes with me, and waved. Like a cheerful little wave, fingers wiggling, with this big, silent smile plastered on his painted face. Then, he just kept pushing. No sound, no words, like it was the most normal thing in the world. Oh my god, I muttered, backing up. I didn't wait for more. I spun around, bolted back to my room, slammed the door, and locked it. Peeing in a bottle? Yeah, that's what I did. Grabbed an empty water bottle from my bag, squatted over it in the corner like some feral animal, praying I wouldn't miss. It was humiliating, but better than whatever the hell was going on in that bathroom. The next morning, I woke up groggy, convinced it was a dream. Had to be, right? I mean, who squats in a mime outfit at 2 a.m.? But the bottle was there on the nightstand, a gross reminder. I dumped it in the sink. My room had a tiny one, thank God, and headed downstairs for breakfast, determined to act normal. Mrs. Hargrove was in the kitchen, flipping pancakes.
Morning, dear. Sleep well?
I hesitated, pouring coffee.
Yeah, mostly. Hey, that performer guy you mentioned, what's his deal? Is he like a street artist or something?
She chuckled, sliding a plate my way.
Oh, Marcel? He's a mime performer. Travels around doing shows. Sweet as pie. But yeah, a tad odd. Why do you ask?
I poked at my food. No reason. Just curious. I didn't want to sound crazy, so I kept it vague. The honeymoon couple joined us then. Emily and Tom from Seattle. They were all lovey-dovey, holding hands under the table.
This place is so charming, Emily gushed. We heard the ocean all night.
Did you sleep okay? I forced a laugh. Sort of. Woke up needing the bathroom and ran into something weird. Tom raised an eyebrow. Weird? How? Before I could answer, the door creaked open, and in walked Marcel. No mime getup this time, just jeans and a hoodie, his face scrubbed clean. He looked totally normal, mid-30s, with a shy smile.
Morning, everyone,
he said softly, French accent faint, but there. Mrs. Hargrove beamed.
Marcel, join us! This is Josie, from L.A.
He nodded at me.
Pleasure.
But his eyes lingered a second too long, like he knew. Breakfast dragged on with small talk. Emily chatted about their wedding.
It was on a beach, so romantic.
And Tom asked about my trip. Solo traveling? Brave. I'd get lonely. I shrugged. It's empowering. After a breakup, you know? Needed space. Marcel stayed quiet, mostly, but then he turned to me.
You are from Los Angeles? I perform there sometimes. Mimes are not so popular anymore, but I try.
Yeah? What kind of shows? He smiled faintly.
Silent stories. Invisible walls. Trapped in boxes. People laugh, but it's deeper. About feeling confined.
The way he said it sent a chill up my spine. Was he hinting, or was I paranoid? After breakfast, I cornered Mrs. Hargrove in the hall. Listen, last night, I think I saw Marcel in the bathroom, dressed as a mime. It was bizarre. Her face paled a bit.
Oh, honey, Marcel's harmless, but he has his quirks. Insomnia, you see. Sometimes he practices at night. Says the silence helps.
Practices? Squatting on the floor? She sighed.
He's had a rough past. Lost his family young in France. Performs to cope. Maybe it caught him in a routine. I'm sorry if it scared you.
I nodded, but it didn't sit right. Later, I bumped into Marcel outside, smoking a cigarette by the garden. Hey, I said, about last night. He exhaled smoke slowly.
You saw me?
Yeah. What the hell was that? He looked away toward the ocean.
It was a performance for myself. I cannot sleep sometimes. The mime helps me release. No words, just action. I did not mean to frighten you.
Release what? You were pushing like...
Like I was trapped,
he interrupted gently.
In my head. It's therapy. The costume makes it real.
I stared. Therapy? In a shared bathroom. He shrugged.
The house is quiet at night. I forget others are here.
Then he smiled that same silent smile from before.
Forgive me?
I muttered, sure, and walked away. But my mind raced. Was he lying, or was it really that innocent? That afternoon, I explored the town. Cute shops, cliffs overlooking the sea. Emily and Tom invited me for coffee.
So, spill about that weird thing last night, Emily said, leaning in.
I told them everything, whispering like it was a ghost story. Tom laughed. Dude sounds nuts. Mime therapy? Come on. Emily frowned.
That's kind of sad, though. If he's dealing with trauma, and... I had a friend who did weird stuff after her dad died.
Art heals, right? Yeah, maybe, I said, but doubt nagged at me. Back at the B&B, Mr. Thompson, the writer, finally emerged. Gray hair, glasses, carrying a notebook. We chatted in the parlor.
Heard you're curious about Marcel, he said, voice gravelly.
Word travels fast, he chuckled.
Small house. Marcel's a character. Been coming here for years. Mrs. Hargrove says he's like a son. But between you and me, I've seen him wandering at night. Once he was in the garden, miming a whole conversation with nobody.
My stomach twisted. Creepy.
Or creative,
Thomas replied.
Writers do weird shit too. Inspiration strikes odd hours.
Around midnight, I heard footsteps in the hall. Heart pounding, I cracked my door. There was Marcel, in normal clothes, heading downstairs. I followed quietly, peeking into the living room. He was sitting by the window, staring at the moon. No costume, just still. Like he was miming peace. I slipped back to bed, relieved but unsettled. Maybe it was nothing. The next morning, I packed to leave. Mrs. Hargrove hugged me goodbye.
Safe travels, dear. And don't worry about Marcel. He's just a lost soul finding his way.
Marcel waved from the porch.
Au revoir, Josie. Perhaps our paths cross again.
I drove off, the ocean in my rear view, but the image stuck with me. Weeks later, back in LA, I Googled him. Marcel the Mime. Turns out, he was semi-famous in Europe. Lost his wife in a car accident years ago. Articles mentioned his eccentric coping mechanisms. Night rituals in order to mime away the pain. It hit me then. He wasn't pooping or anything gross. He was miming release, pushing out invisible demons.
Therapy in stripes.
I was half dead by the time I reached the motel. 5 days of back-to-back panels, networking mixers, and pitching at an influencer summit had wrung every ounce of energy out of me. I'd gotten maybe 10 hours of sleep across the entire week. I could have passed out on gravel. The motel was off the interstate, about 20 minutes from the airport. The kind of place you don't look at too closely. The flickering neon sign, damp carpet, scratchy sheets, and a faint mustiness that clung to the air like mold. Still, it was cheap and had a bed. That was enough. I didn't even bother brushing my teeth and face-planted onto the mattress. I was out before 8 p.m. I don't know how long I was asleep for when the phone rang.
Hello?
My voice cracked. Front desk, a man said. His voice was flat, like someone reading off a script. We received a noise complaint from your room. My brain was too fogged to understand.
What? I've been sleeping. I haven't made a sound.
There was a pause. Then, Are you alone in the room, ma'am?
What? Yes, of course. There's no one else here but me.
I said, rubbing my face. You're sure you're by yourself, ma'am?
Yes! I'm alone. No one else. No noise.
I snapped, annoyed. All right, he said slowly, and the line clicked dead. I collapsed back into sleep without giving it another thought. The next morning, the memory came rushing back. Something about the call had been off. The way he'd asked me the same question twice, the tone, the phrasing, and strangest of all, I hadn't heard a single sound in the motel that night. No TV, no footsteps in the hallway, no muffled arguments through the walls. Dead quiet. I stopped at the front desk on my way out for coffee.
Hey, did you guys call me last night about a noise complaint?
The woman at the counter frowned.
No, we didn't have any calls or complaints logged.
My stomach turned.
So, no one called room 308 around 11?
She shook her head. Is that your room?
Yeah.
She hesitated, then leaned in slightly. Did the caller ask if you were alone?
Yeah, twice.
Her eyes narrowed. You should have reported that. I left my coffee behind. Back in the room, something felt wrong. I double-checked the latch on the door, still hooked. But I could swear something had been moved. My phone charger wasn't where I'd left it, and the little bolt in the bathroom window was unlocked. I hadn't touched it. I checked the closet, the bathroom, under the bed. Nothing. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that someone had been inside. Paranoia's a funny thing. I tried brushing it off. Maybe I'd been too tired to remember locking the window. Maybe I knocked the charger myself. Maybe the call was a prank. But around 4 p.m., the motel's Wi-Fi kicked me off. When I went to reconnect, I saw a network pop up. 308 cam. My heart stopped. I tapped it, but it was locked, encrypted. I bolted to the front desk again. The woman was gone, replaced by a balding man who had barely looked up from his magazine.
Who cleaned room 308 before I checked in?
He shrugged. We don't do daily turnarounds. Nobody's been in there since last week.
No staff at all?
Nope.
I stared at him. He didn't blink.
Have you ever got calls from guests saying they've been asked weird questions, like if they're alone?
He gave me a look.
This is a motel, ma'am. We get lots of weird calls.
Back in my room, I checked every outlet, every vent, the fire alarm on the ceiling. Finally, above the wardrobe, tucked behind a loose ceiling tile, I found it. A small, cheap Wi-Fi enabled spy cam, battery operated, with the narrow lens pointing right at the bed. I nearly vomited. My first instinct was to smash it. But then I remembered, if I wanted proof, I had to be smart. I packed my bag, went outside, and called a friend from back home who worked in tech investigations. He walked me through what to grab. Footage, metadata, MAC address, and timestamps. I got it all. And then I waited. That night, I left the room looking untouched. Clothes on the floor, TV remote on the bed, bathroom light on. I booked the room next door instead and waited, listening. At exactly 2:17 a.m., I heard the lock on 308 click. Through the peephole of my new room, I saw him. Not a motel employee, young guy, black hoodie, carrying what looked like a toolkit and a laptop bag. He slipped into my room like he'd done it 100 times. I called 911 and told them someone had broken into my room. They caught him 20 minutes later, coming out with his backpack stuffed full of electronics. Turns out, he'd done it before, multiple times, across different states. He would scan for solo female travelers, exhausted, careless, vulnerable, and spy on them. Sometimes he sold the footage, sometimes he just watched. The motel knew. He wasn't an employee, but he'd paid a manager with the promise of uncut footage to get access to master keys. They denied everything, of course. The case is still on. I've never slept in a motel again. And I always, always use the chain lock.
For our 5th anniversary, Daniel rented a cabin next to Hawkins Lake. We'd never been there before, but the photos looked gorgeous. We both grew up in a very landlocked area, so we were fascinated by lakeside communities like Hawken. We checked into our cabin, which was just as nice as the pictures. It had its own dock, with a cute blue rowboat just for us. I couldn't wait to ride around the lake. It seemed so romantic. But first, we headed into town for a walk around. Daniel really wanted to try the boat out, but I convinced him to explore the area first. I just love people watching. We were browsing through a cute little antique shop when I noticed a girl with pale blue eyes staring at me from the other side of a shelf of clocks. She didn't move. She didn't say anything. She just stared at me, and not in a friendly way. "Can I help you?" The girl disappeared behind some shelves. I'm not sure why I followed her. I guess I was a little creeped out by her pale blue eyes. I looked all around the store until I spotted her behind a rocking chair. She was still staring. I cornered her. "Is there something wrong?" "Don't get in the boat." I was so unnerved by what she said, I let her walk right past me. Daniel walked over with an old radio that he wanted me to see, and he asked me what was wrong. I must have looked pretty spooked. I told him about the strange girl's warning, and he scoffed. "Small towns do this kind of stuff all the time. It's a publicity thing, trying to build mystique or whatever." I wanted to believe him, but I couldn't stop shivering. We went back to our cabin after that, and Daniel changed into his swim clothes. He expected me to do the same, but I lost all desire to go to the lake. "I don't want to use that boat. Honey, promise me you won't." He promised, which instantly made me feel better. Daniel always kept his word. I stayed inside, watching him through the window. He was walking along the edge of a lake, letting the water slosh around his feet. He looked up at me and waved. I waved back. The rowboat floated behind him, untouched. I left to grab an iced tea. But when I returned to the window, Daniel was gone. I thought he was swimming until I noticed that the rowboat was gone too. My heart pounded. I knew I was being irrational, but I couldn't help it. That creepy girl had really gotten to me. I waited for Daniel on the couch to come back. He didn't. But after an hour, I decided to go look for him. I waited along the shore, searching for any signs of the blue boat. "Daniel, where are you?" He never answered. Despite some marshy areas, I could see the entire lake, and Daniel was nowhere to be found. I started running along the shore. I slowed when I got to the next cabin. An old man was sitting with a fishing pole on the edge of his dock. "Excuse me. Have you seen a man paddling out there with a boat?" The old man pretended not to hear me, so I repeated myself. He ignored me again. I'm not a confrontational person, but I was desperate. I grabbed the fishing pole out of his hands. "I'm looking for my husband. He should have come back by now." The old man stared at the lake. Was he in a blue rowboat? "Yes. Have you seen him?" Instead of answering, he pointed straight ahead. I followed his gaze and saw a speck of blue in the distance. The boat was floating on the other side of the lake, and it was empty. Still wearing my regular clothes, I jumped off the dock and started swimming. The water was colder than I thought. It would have been refreshing if I wasn't in such a panic. I was swimming as fast as I could, and suddenly I got a cramp in my side. And I was barely getting enough oxygen, but I just couldn't stop. In minutes, I reached the other side of the lake. I grabbed the side of the boat and climbed in. Daniel's flip-flops were inside, but the rest of him wasn't. I called out for Daniel, but no answer. I paddled around, scanning the surface of the water, and after 30 minutes of searching, I gave up. I needed help. I rode to the dock and then raced back to the main street. I went into the first shop I saw and told them that my husband was missing. It was a bait shop, and the older man behind the counter looked at me with pity. Not surprised, though. I asked him if he knew what happened. He shrugged. "Sorry, ma'am. I have no idea." Then a girl walked out from behind the counter. The same small girl with pale blue eyes. She gave the old man a single nod, and the man headed into the back room. Now it was just me and the girl. She walked towards me, her expression blank. Then she gave me a tight hug. I waited for her to speak. "I'm glad you're safe. Thanks for listening to me." "Safe from what? What happened?" The girl let me go and walked into the back room, probably to join her grandfather. I never got any more information after that. I filed a missing persons report with the local police, and they formed a search party. Although Daniel was never found, and the little blue rowboat, the one I tied to our dock, that was gone too. This story is inspired from a real-life event. In May 2025, authorities recovered a body from Georgia's Lake Lanier, days after a kayaker, Dustin Valencia, went missing. Valencia, 43, a father of five, vanished on May 14th after taking his family's inflatable kayak onto a vast lake. His kayak and paddle were found, but he remained missing until May 16th, when the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office announced the body's recovery. Valencia's wife reported him missing as he failed to pick up their children from school. His car was found parked nearby. Officials noted his kayak seats were not inflated or installed. Identification of the recovered body remained pending.
Crimson velvet roses gnawed at my sanity. Dozens of them, dripping dew onto the worn mahogany coffee table, their scent clogging the air like cloying perfume. Each petal mirrored the raw ache in my throat, pulsing with the ghost of promises never kept. It was Valentine's Day, and in my studio apartment they mocked me like silent accusers. 3 years ago, on this very day, Liam had declared his love under the Eiffel Tower, the sign twinkling like a promise beside us. A year later, the roses withered as he ghosted me through a single text.
"Maybe this year,"
I whispered, staring at the petals. A hollow laugh escaped, echoing in the emptiness. Of course, this year wouldn't be different. Hope, a flickering butterfly, took flight in my chest. Perhaps a delivery gone wrong. A surprise gift from a generous neighbor. But the man outside wasn't a neighbor. He was tall, gaunt, with eyes the color of storm clouds. Single crimson rose, its stem dripping black liquid, was tucked behind his ear.
"Miss Evelyn Thorne?"
His voice was a rough rasp, like sandpaper against bone. My breath hitched.
Yes?
"A delivery for you,"
he said, offering the rose. Something about him, the chilling glint in his eyes, sent a shiver down my spine. But the familiar loneliness, the desperation for connection, urged me forward. I reached for the rose, my fingers grazing the black ichor that stained its stem. He chuckled a low, unsettling sound.
"Enjoy the gift, Ms. Thorne. It blooms only for you."
Before I could question him further, he turned and melted into the shadows, leaving me alone with the nightmarish rose. Curiosity, morbid and twisted, tugged at me. I brought the flower closer, inhaling its cloying metallic scent. It throbbed, a grotesque pulse against my palm. Then, with a sickeningly wet pop, the rose's bud split open, Not delicate petals, but pale, fleshy fingers curled out, gripping my skin. A scream ripped from my throat as it latched onto my hand, burrowing beneath the flesh. Agony pulsed through me, white hot and blinding. I tore the thing away, flinging it across the room. It landed on the coffee table, its tiny limbs writhing, the black ichor oozing from its wounds. But even on the table, it pulsed, connected to me by an invisible cord of pain. Panic choked me. I ripped open drawers, searching for something, anything, to destroy it. A knife, a lighter, anything to sever the connection, the agony. My desperate cries echoed in the sterile space. Finally, in the back of a dusty drawer, I found it. An old vial filled with a clear liquid, a memento from my late grandmother, a renowned herbalist. She'd called it Tears of Willow. With trembling hands, I splashed the liquid on the writhing creature, and it disintegrated into a pile of dust. The pain receded, leaving behind a phantom throb and a chilling dread. Collapsing onto the floor, I cradled my throbbing hand, the memory of the tiny, flesh-hungry fingers imprinted on my skin. Outside, the city hummed with celebrations, a cruel symphony against the horrors witnessed within my four walls. Sleep didn't come, only restless nightmares filled with writhing roses and cold, storm-cloud eyes. Morning found me drawn magnetically back to the coffee table. The dust from the destroyed rose lay undisturbed, but the black ichor had spread, forming intricate symbols on the wood. My heart hammered. I recognized the symbols. Ancient, forbidden script from one of my grandmother's books, detailing rites of dark magic. Rites of sacrifice, of transference. A cold realization gripped me. The rose, the delivery, the storm cloud eyes that mirrored Liam's. Then I remembered. My birthday was one day before Valentine's, a detail I'd often mentioned to Liam. He knew. He'd orchestrated this, using my loneliness, my desperation, as a twisted offering. The city outside, with its red decorations and forced cheer, suddenly felt suffocating. My sanctuary, my studio, now bore the scars of a nightmare. But fear wouldn't save me. This wasn't a love story gone wrong, it was a twisted game of vengeance, one I was now forced to play. I scoured Liam's online profiles, old social media accounts, anything that might reveal his whereabouts. Days bled into nights, fueled by coffee and paranoia. Finally, a clue. A grainy photo with the unmistakable silhouette of an abandoned church in the background. The church, shrouded in mist and silence, felt less like a holy space and more like a mausoleum. Inside, the pews lay dusty, the air thick with incense and something akin to rot. A single red rose wilted on the altar, its stem an oozing wound. Following an almost imperceptible trail of black ichor, I reached the crypt behind the altar. The air grew colder, and a low whisper, Liam's voice, echoed through the stone walls. Panic gnawed at me, but I gripped the vial tighter, pushing open the creaking door. Liam stood hunched over a pentagram drawn in charcoal, his eyes glazed with madness. Crimson candles cast grotesque shadows on his face, etched with a twisted satisfaction. In the center of the pentagram, bound by thorny vines, was a woman. Sarah, Liam's ex-girlfriend, the one he supposedly ghosted me for.
Evelyn,
Liam hissed, a cruel smile twisting his lips.
Come to join the party?
His words confirmed my worst suspicions. This wasn't just about me. It was about feeding his insatiable hunger. Not quite, I said, my voice surprisingly steady. I came to finish your little game. I flung the vial at the pentagram. The willow tears hit the ground like liquid sunlight, dissolving the charcoal lines and sending tendrils of emerald light across the crypt. Sarah gasped, the thorny vines around her loosening. Liam screamed, recoiling as the light reached him, burning away the dark magic that had fueled his twisted desires. He stumbled back, the madness draining from his eyes, replaced by stark terror. It was like watching a monster shrink back into the man he once was. And the sight fueled my rage.
"Why, Liam?"
I choked, the question raw in my throat. He cowered, mumbling about lost love and a desperate need to prove something. His justifications were pathetic, mere echoes of a mind corrupted by his own darkness. In that moment, I realized pity held no place in this crypt. There was only justice, cold and swift. Grabbing a fallen candelabra, I raised it over my head. He didn't beg, didn't fight, he just closed his eyes. Just as I was about to end him, a voice ripped through the crypt's silence. Sarah, freed from the thorns, stumbled toward us, her eyes wild.
"No, Evelyn!" she cried. "Don't become like him!"
Her plea hung heavy in the air, a reminder of the darkness I teetered on the edge of. Liam deserved punishment, but my revenge wouldn't erase the scars he'd left on us both. Lowering the candelabra, I watched as Sarah, shaken but alive, stumbled towards Liam. Their reunion was messy, filled with tears and accusations, but it was theirs to navigate. As for me, I turned and walked away, the emerald light of the willow tears painting my path out of the darkness.